Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we learn about the Wisconsinites who are competing in the Tokyo Paralympics. First, in an address to the nation yesterday, President Biden defended his administration's handling of the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. The last U.S. troops left the country Monday, but the administration says that an estimated 1 to 200 Americans who wish to come home are still in Afghanistan. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about the withdrawal from Afghanistan, the debate over resettling Afghan refugees across the U.S., and how the impact of a number of challenges has affected the Biden's polling, President Biden's polling numbers. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the end of the two-decade-long war in Afghanistan? What do you think about the administration's decision to withdraw from the country? And about the growing debate over Afghan refugees with special visas coming to the United States. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Adam Ulner is a deputy editor from McClatchy, D.C. Adam, welcome back.
Hey, thanks so much for having me on.
Well, let's give a listen to some of yesterday's address from President Biden. Here it is.
We're left with a simple decision. Either follow through on the commitment made by the last administration and leave Afghanistan, or say we weren't leaving and commit another tens of thousands more troops going back to war. That was the choice, the real choice, between leaving or escalating.
Adam, can you talk more about the case the president was making yesterday?
Yeah, really, I think, you know, President Biden yesterday was sought to sort of, you know, defend this whole process, because obviously these past few weeks have been very trying for the administration, both from the perspective of, you know, having to deal with the loss of several U.S. service members, and also just, you know, from a larger political standpoint. Really, this is the most criticism that they've faced, you know, so far since President Biden took office from both sides of the aisle. So with, you know, Once the U.S. had gotten past that August 31st withdrawal date, you know, officially ending a nearly 20-year war in Afghanistan, you know, I think he felt like he needed to outline to the American people exactly why he took the steps that he did, and why they maybe weren't always easy or didn't always, you know, maybe to some people seem like the right ones, but why he feels that they were, and why, you know, over time that, you know, that, you know, history will judge him in a positive light. So I think, you know, this is certainly still something he's going to have to continue to defend for some time. Some of the polling that has come out over the past few weeks show that, you know, a majority of Americans, while they do support his overall decision to end the war in Afghanistan, that's something that the public has supported for some time now, that they, you know, a pretty solid majority doesn't approve of the way in which it was handled. You know, a lot of the chaotic scenes that have been playing out, you know, on everyone's TV screens for the past few weeks. So I think, you know, this was, you know, one of his, you know, perhaps his most forceful effort yet to defend his decision. And, you know, it's likely one that he will have to continue to defend in the coming weeks.
In that excerpt we heard from the speech, as you mentioned, there are two points here, the decision to withdraw and then the handling of that withdrawal. It seems like President Biden is trying to focus the conversation on the big picture decision to pull out U.S. troops, where the big criticism of the administration has been more over how that was done, right?
Absolutely. And because he knows that the public is with him on that first part of the argument, and has been for some time, right? That, you know, especially over time, as, you know, as with any news event, you know, it will fade and other things will take in its place. And especially when, you know, you talk about voters going to the polls again, whether that's next year or in 2024, you know, when they're thinking about what the president has done, what his administration has done, you know, I think he's betting on that ultimately they will reward him for following through on that campaign promise to end the war. That's ultimately what he did. You know, maybe it didn't unfold exactly how people wanted, but I think he's betting that over time that will sort of fade and people will, you know, basically, you know, just appreciate that the war is now over, and that, you know, there won't be any more risk for loss of life of American service members there going forward.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jerry is with us in Waukesha. Jerry, hi.
Hi there.
What do you think?
I guess my first question is, that conditional agreement that President Trump drafted with the Taliban, is that a classified document or is that available to the general public? Because I'd be curious to know how that read out and what the process was going to be, because whatever process we saw and we heard about wasn't even a process. It was like a clown show with 20 clowns getting out of a VW. That's about how well it was orchestrated and carried out.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Do we know, had the Trump administration and Secretary of State Pompeo, they had negotiated the fact of withdrawal directly with the Taliban, leaving out the Afghan government. Do we know that they reached planning stages of the logistics of the withdrawal?
Certainly not to the specifics that we've seen here in the past few weeks, because that agreement was initially that the withdrawal date would start May 1st of this year. And obviously that would have been just a few months after President Biden took office. So they moved that deadline back a little bit later in the year. And again, you know, I think, you know, as the caller expressed, I think a lot of Americans do, you know, agree with the sentiment that, you know, the evacuation itself could have gone much smoother. You know, even if they do agree again with the overall decision to end the war, and, you know, and maybe if that deadline would have been extended a little bit longer, maybe things would have gone smoother. You know, it's really impossible to know at this point, but with President Biden, you know, has outlined in recent days that he, you know, he followed the advice of the military commanders and then the generals, you know, in the U.S. military. And they ultimately said that they should still stick by that August 31st deadline. So that's ultimately what they decided to do.
Jerry, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. It's the Week in Washington. We're talking about some of the top stories in national politics, including the withdrawal from Afghanistan and next Afghan refugees coming to the United States. In the United States now, you can join in with your thoughts on that and how you want to see this resettlement process go at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Adam, you've written some about the politics of the acceptance of Afghan refugees, especially those with these special visas that they applied for after having worked with Americans in Afghanistan. What are you seeing in terms of the politics surrounding that?
Right. Yeah, that's going to be, you know, another, you know, huge issue now moving forward after this evacuation of around 120,000 people from Afghanistan, which included both Americans, but also Afghan allies who have been working with U.S. troops and officials throughout the course of the war. You know, getting them resettled is going to be, you know, both, you know, just a logistical issue, but also a political issue as well. It is something that a vast majority of Americans do, you know, agree that the U.S. should play a role in helping these Afghan refugees get settled in the United States. You know, some polling has suggested upwards of 80% of Americans feel that that's something the U.S. should do, and even 76% of Republicans. However, you do have, you know, a vocal minority within the Republican Party that includes some big names, you know, including former President Donald Trump, who have raised concerns about some of these Afghan allies who are coming to the U.S., raising concerns that they are not being properly vetted and that could, you know, potentially lead to issues down the road in the U.S. You know, that's something that the administration and their allies have forcefully pushed against, you know, noting that these people are, you know, first vetted in Afghanistan before they even began working with them, and then were vetted again before coming to the United States. So, you know, even though it is something that is very popular with most Americans, and especially in, you know, in this polarized environment, you don't really see many issues where you have, you know, 4 out of 5 Americans agreeing on something. You are still going to have that sort of vocal minority from the Republican Party raising these concerns, and that, you know, will put pressure on a lot of these Republican governors, you know, Republicans who, you know, lead towns and cities across the country as they decide whether or not to accept some of these refugees.
Republicans challenging the vetting process for some of these Afghan refugees include Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, who's raised concerns after a visit to Fort McCoy, where some of those refugees are arriving. But you said they're a vocal minority in the Republican Party. What are we hearing from other Republicans in support of taking in Afghan refugees?
That's right. You know, based on our reporting from earlier this week, we have heard from at least 9 Republican governors across the country who said that they would welcome these refugees into their states. So I think it is notable that a lot of the, you know, kind of the concerns that are being raised right now are being raised among people that won't necessarily have, you know, any kind of direct impact over that process. You're talking about, again, you know, former President Trump. You're talking about some members of Congress. It's ultimately going to be more at the state and local level where some of these decisions are made. But again, if they are feeling some of that political pressure from their base, you know, that could make decisions along these lines a little bit trickier for them from a political standpoint.
Let's go back to our callers now. Mark is with us in Wautoma. Mark, hello.
Hi. I'm just wondering, how many refugees do you think we're going to be prepared to take in as a country? I mean, we didn't take in very many Syrian refugees after our military operation there. And I just heard your guest say that the decisions will be made at a local level. I'm wondering how that's even possible when they have to go through federal immigration processes to get to the United States.
Mark, thanks for that call. The overall number, I think, will be decided at the federal level. And is that still an open question, Adam?
Yeah, it is. We don't know the exact number yet. You know, the administration has said that they evacuated 120,000 people from Afghanistan, but that includes both Americans and Afghan allies. And as far as I know, they haven't exactly decided the split for that yet. And I should say, you know, it certainly is a partnership between the federal, you know, and the state and local governments. You know, it kind of, you know, starts at the federal level, but in order for everything to ultimately be carried out, a lot of that will happen at the state and local level.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Adam Wollner, deputy editor with McClatchy, D.C. He's with us today for a weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you or someone you know a refugee who has been resettled in the U.S.? What has it meant to you? Do you support the resettlement of Afghan refugees in Wisconsin and elsewhere? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our look at the top stories in national politics. Adam Wollner is with us with McClatchy, D.C. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the U.S. taking in Afghan refugees. And coming up, we'll look ahead at 2022 politics and elections. 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's go back to our callers now with Tom in Lake Geneva. Tom, mm-hmm. Hi.
Hello. Thank you so much. I am a honorably discharged Air Force captain, and I've been a very proud American for many, many, many years. I hate to admit it, but I'm really embarrassed to be an American at this point with what's been happening with our formerly great nation. I was just totally blown away watching President Biden kept looking at his watch, being totally bored, waiting for the caskets to pass so he could get back to whatever else he was doing. I just can't believe what's happening to this formerly great nation of ours, and I can't really believe it.
Tom, thanks a lot for the call. There is that level of frustration out there, Adam, with some people watching what's going on with the withdrawal from Afghanistan.
That's right. And, you know, this is something that's obviously been building now for nearly 20 years across several administrations. And, you know, it's something now that several presidents have expressed that they wanted to do. And we can see why, you know, maybe, in, you know, some recent presidents, whether, you know, both President Obama and President Trump, you know, ultimately never were able to go all the way through with the withdrawal from Afghanistan, because it is, you know, a politically difficult decision. And, you know, it's never going to be, you know, easy to wrap this sort of thing up. You know, of course, you know, you can certainly argue and debate, you know, whether or not the administration made some wrong decisions, and that could have led to a smoother process, but it was certainly never going to be easy. So you can see why, you know, this is a decision that kind of kept on getting pushed further and further down the road. And now here we are, almost 20 years later, and it's finally come to an end, but again, not in a way that I think a lot of people wanted to see.
Thanks for that call, Tom. We'll go now to Owen in Wyoega. Owen, hi.
Hi, Rob. Yeah, of course, you know, you're going to get political fallback from this issue, no matter what choice you made. But my question is, I have heard conflicting things about refugees and how resettlement works. So when they come to the end of the country, are they immediately able to be granted citizenship, meaning they become United States citizens and they can participate in democracy after they've been naturalized? And how long does that take? And how long are they exempt from paying income taxes before, after they gain residency.
Owen, thanks a lot for the call. Owen saying it was a difficult decision in either case. But question about refugees. By understanding, a quick lookup, refugees do pay taxes if they make income. And it's, I believe, like any other person immigrating to the country, there's a citizenship process that they have to go through. Adam, I don't know if you've been following that. Do you have anything to add?
That's right. No, I'm certainly not an expert on this process, but I can tell you, again, obviously that if they wanted to apply for citizenship, that process, takes years. And really the first step for these allies who are coming through it is to get what's called a special immigrant visa, essentially. So that's really the first step of this process, but citizenship, which they wouldn't have to apply for, but if they wanted to, that's a years long process.
Thanks for the call, Owen, at 800-642-1234. We're talking to Adam Wallner with McClatchy, D.C., looking at some of the top stories in national news. I want to turn to some other stories out there related to Afghanistan and other things going on in the country. A decline in President Biden's polling numbers. What are we seeing there?
That's right. Kind of amid this Afghanistan withdrawal, we've seen Biden's polling numbers drop. So far, it's to the lowest point of his presidency. He had been pretty comfortably above, kind of just above 50% for most of the past 7 months. But both between this and what a lot of the pollsters that I've talked to think has actually been a bigger contributor to his declining poll numbers has actually been the coronavirus resurgence as a sort of the Delta variant has spread. And I think a lot of people were preparing for the end of the summer and into the fall that the pandemic would begin to recede, but it really has come back with a vengeance in a lot of ways. So I think people are frustrated by that, and we've seen in the polling that his handling of the pandemic, which usually he earned very high marks from the public for, that has decreased. So which is why we've seen him continue to push for people to get vaccinated. He pushed for private businesses to impose vaccine mandates to get those numbers up to where the administration wants, where they think that they can start to really kind of make headway against this Delta variant.
Democrats worried about those polling numbers as they look forward to 2022. You have your eyes on election season 2021, though. Some governor's races around the country and some lessons maybe on how Democrats are going to run without a fellow named Donald Trump on any ballots anywhere. What kind of things are you looking at?
That's right. Obviously, he was a huge motivator for Democrats in both 2018 and 2020, inspiring, record high turnout and, obviously allowed Democrats to take full control of Washington. But now, kind of starting here this fall, Democrats are going to sort of get their first test of how can they continue to energize people to come out to vote when Trump is no longer in office and no longer can sort of be the villain that inspires a lot of these people. We're going to see some examples of that already next month. And in fact, voting's already underway in a recall election, which of course, Wisconsinites are very familiar with, mm-hmm. out in California, where Democratic Governor Gavin Newsom is facing a recall vote. And then later this fall in November, there are a couple of other governor's races, but Virginia is one that political operatives on both sides often look to as a potential barometer for where the political environment is 1 year after the last presidential election and 1 year but before the next midterm. So I think it'll give Democrats a bit of a test run and an idea of how they need to adjust their tactics going into 2022 when they're going to be defending their slim majorities in the House and the Senate.
Let's go back to our callers with Bill on the line in Watertown. Bill, hi. Are you there, Bill?
Oh, hello. Yes, I'm still here. I think that Democrats are going to be energized to vote with the narrow margins in the House and the Senate breaking even, minus one vote for the vice president, to reestablish a larger majority so they can get something done, since Republicans aren't really doing anything at all. And I'm a former Republican that could no longer vote Republican after a Trump episode, which was just horrific.
Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Bill, seeing Democrats energized to try to keep and maybe build a majority, and an issue we haven't touched on. We're going to talk about this on the show on Friday. Roe versus Wade and abortion, with this Texas law coming into effect, the Supreme Court not stepping in, maybe another element energizing voters on the Democratic side. What do you think, Adam?
That's right. I think, you know, especially if abortion politics really starts to sort of take center stage here, then, you know, I think, you know, strategists on both sides will begin to sort of rethink what, you know, how things are going to be shaped going into 2022. But, you know, kind of regardless of exactly what issue takes center stage, you know, a midterm election in a president's first year in office is always difficult for that party that's in power. They've historically had big losses. You know, we can look back to 2018. We can look back to 2010. So, you know, I think Democrats are going to be fighting headwinds regardless. Republicans are going to be energized to try and take back the House and the Senate and serve as sort of a check on President Biden. But I think there are certainly a lot of issues, abortion being one of them, that will also serve to energize the left. And a lot of times these midterm elections just comes down to which side is more energized. And obviously we'll have a much better idea of that about in about a year or so from now.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call. Adam, what story do you have your eye on in the week or two to come?
Well, once we, you know, get back from the Labor Day weekend here, the attention is going to turn pretty quickly back to President Biden's economic agenda. They're hoping to get, you know, the infrastructure bill and the sort of reconciliation budget bill that's kind of paired alongside that passed at some point this fall. This is another thing that Democrats think that they really need to get done here in the next month or two, so that they have something to run on and show the American people sort of what they were able to accomplish for them and that they were able to deliver on some of their campaign promises. So, you know, this is going to be a big stretch for the Democrats here, trying to get President Biden's economic agenda through Congress.
And very briefly, Adam, you drew attention to a tweet you had posted in 2013. Can't wait until Giannis Antetokounmpo leads the Bucks to an NBA title in 2023. How do you feel about being off by a couple years?
I'm glad that I was off, you know, 2 years early rather than 2 years late. I tweeted that just on a limb, you know, certainly tongue in cheek on draft night in 2013. But I couldn't be happier that it actually became reality here. So, you know, I'm still riding high even more than a month after the Bucks became NBA champions.
Adam, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you.
That's Adam Molnar, deputy editor for McClatchy, D.C. He was with us today for a weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. Coming up after the news, we'll hear about the athlete representing Wisconsin in the Tokyo Paralympics going on right now. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, the author of a new book shares the story of a Wisconsin woman who played a big role in resistance to the Nazis in pre-World War II Germany. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Now, the Paralympic Games are being held in Tokyo. They're running through September 5th. Wisconsin will be represented by 7 athletes competing in archery, paratriathlon, wheelchair rugby, wheelchair basketball, and swimming. This year, the Paralympic Games have got more attention on them than before, with NBC broadcasting primetime coverage for the first time ever. Here's a listen to the call of some of the U.S. women's wheelchair basketball squad in a game against China, which the U.S. ultimately lost in a nail-biter by just 1 point.
Zerbrug rattles in the 3-ball.
Connects from NBA range, puts the U.S. within 3. Beautiful hit from Lindsay Zerbrug.
We are talking now about the Paralympics, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you watching the Paralympics? What's been your favorite sport to watch? Do you participate in adaptive sports yourself, or does someone in your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Megan Hart is a sports reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio based in Green Bay. Megan, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I want to hear some about the athletes representing the USA, and we have a big Wisconsin presence in the sport of wheelchair basketball. Can you start us off there, please?
Sure. Yeah. So actually, a third of the U.S. men's wheelchair basketball team hails from Wisconsin. There's John Boy from Milton. He's making his Olympic Paralympic debut in Tokyo. Nate Hines, who is a three-time Paralympian from Cedar Grove. He won gold in Rio and bronze in London. Jake Williams from Milwaukee, who also won gold in Rio. And then Matt LeBrons, who is at his second Paralympics. He was at the 2008 Games, and now he is back with the U.S. men's wheelchair basketball team. And they are going to play Spain in a semifinal later this week. They beat Turkey in the quarterfinal, so those guys are still in medal contention.
And people might be asking, why is Wisconsin so prominently represented in this sport? And the answer is UW-Whitewater. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. UW-Whitewater has one of the most successful wheelchair basketball programs in the country. They've actually won 16 national titles for the men and three for the women, and the men's program has been around a lot longer. But they have a real history of success that goes beyond just those players that happen to be from Wisconsin. There's also Lindsay Zerbrug, who is in the highlight you just played. She is a native of Oregon, but played at UW-Whitewater on the women's wheelchair basketball team. And then there's also Matt Scott, who is from Detroit, and he's a five-time Paralympian, having won gold in Rio and bronze in London, and he played at UW-Whitewater as well. So they've got a real history in the sport.
And just staying with UW-Whitewater, I understand from your reporting, actually, Megan, these aren't just American players who end up playing. They're drawing people from around the world in some cases.
Right. I talked to the men's head coach, A.J. Messmer, and he said that, you know, they've had so much success as a team because they attract athletes who want to come and work hard and know that by playing at UW-Whitewater, they'll have a chance to reach the Paralympic level. And that includes players from all over the world. So there are players he mentioned on the German and Dutch women's team who played there.
And then Christina Schwab, you mentioned head coach of the UW-Whitewater women's wheelchair basketball team. She is a coaching now in the Paralympics. Can you tell us a little more about her?
Sure. She's had such an exciting career. She's from Dane County originally, and she's a five-time Paralympian. She actually started her Paralympic journey in track and field back in Sydney, and you can tell what an athlete she is, having then transitioned and played four more Paralympics on the wheelchair basketball team, having actually won gold in 2004, 2008, and 2016. And like you said, she's now the women's coach at UW-Whitewater, but her former coach took over the men's team and asked her, because he just had such success working with her in the past, to come and be on the men's coaching staff. So she is making history as the first woman to coach on the U.S. men's wheelchair basketball staff.
We're talking to WPR sports reporter Megan Hart about the Paralympics going on now in Tokyo and Wisconsin's delegation there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are following the Paralympics, if you are a fan or current or former member of the UW-Whitewater wheelchair basketball teams, call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Wheelchair basketball, not the only game in town. Megan, let's visit in with some of the other athletes now. An archer, Leah Coriel, who I understand competed today.
Right. Leah's from La Crosse. She competes in a discipline, an archery discipline called W1. She's actually the first U.S. woman ever to qualify for the Paralympics in that discipline. And she made her Olympic debut back in Rio at age 51. She finished fourth in a team event there and seventh in the individual event. And she competed today, and she finished fourth in the individual event. But she's just, you know, like so many Olympic and Paralympic athletes, just has such an incredible story. She's an Army veteran, and she last year actually was hospitalized multiple times with complications from COVID-19, but has just come back so strong, not only competing and making a medal run at these Paralympics, but also winning her first gold medal at an international competition this year and the 2021 Pan American Championships in Mexico.
And then we've got the para triathlon event and Haley Danz of Wisconsin. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, Haley is from Wauwatosa. She now lives out in Colorado Springs and is an avid athlete, so she enjoys downhill skiing out there now, but she's competed at her second Paralympics in Tokyo, winning her second silver medal in the paratriathlon. And she finished second to her teammate, Alyssa Seeley. So two Americans on top of the podium, and they're actually training partners. So it was an exciting day for them on Saturday when they had that race. And she's won 6 world championship medals in the triathlon and just has had an incredible career as one of the elite athletes in the sport.
And then wheelchair rugby, and you talked to Joe Delgrave, who is participating, I think, for the second time in the Paralympic Games.
Yeah, I talked to Joe just before he left. He is lives out in Holman. He's from Prairie du Chien, and he competed in London where his wheelchair rugby team won bronze, and he didn't make the team in Tokyo. And so when I talked to him, he mentioned, you know, it was really kind of hard this time around. His oldest son was 6 months old in 2012 when he was in London, and his son Braxton was at those games, but of course doesn't remember anything from them. And he said now all 3 of his kids are old enough to kind of understand the significance of you know, watching him compete at the Paralympics. And unfortunately, because of restrictions with the pandemic, they weren't able to get out to Tokyo. But so that was hard kind of in the lead up to the games. But when I talked to him just before he left, he said he was just really excited. And that team actually, he was co-captain and they went on to win silver. So now he has not only the bronze from London, but the silver from Tokyo.
Megan, thanks a lot for sharing these stories with us today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That's Megan Hart, sports reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She told us about Wisconsin athletes competing in the Tokyo Paralympics. We'll continue the conversation about adaptive sports and the past, present, and future of the Paralympics. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you or one of your loved ones maybe participate in adaptive sports of one kind or another? How did you get involved? What do you think people get wrong about disabilities and sports? And are you watching the Paralympics right now? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now we're taking a look at the past, present, and future of adaptive sports and the Paralympics. It goes back to post-World War II America when doctors realized disabled veterans could benefit from physical activity. Adaptive sports have come a long way since then, with the first Paralympics taking place in 1960 in Rome. But some athletes say there's still a long way to go. Some Paralympians say they haven't received the support they need to be able to travel and compete in the games. Kara Ayers is Associate Director and an Assistant Professor at the University of Cincinnati's Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities. Kara is a Paralympian swimmer who competed in the 2004 Games in Athens. Kara, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here and talk about this topic.
Well, first, can you share your personal story, your experience in the 2004 Games?
Yeah, definitely. So I was a swimmer, and it was my first large international competition. I was 24, so was sort of, in the middle, if not on the older end of, at that time, of Paralympians, and swam alongside one of the historic Paralympians, Jessica Long, who has captured the gold medal more than once again, and she was 12 at the time. So yeah, it was definitely a life-changing experience, and I swam for another year after that for World Champs, and then kind of pursued my education and life after that.
Now this year we have some primetime coverage of the Paralympics. How have the games changed since you participated in the early 2000s?
Oh my gosh, it's been so much fun to watch the Paralympics on the big screen TV this year, you know, turned on for my kids. And it's really been the first time I think that they've connected, you know, what I did before they were born. And they're able to see this alongside other sports events that we watch, you know, as a family. And that's really the first time that there's been this level of coverage. It's so exciting for my family back home when they wanted to watch me in Athens. Of course, there was a time difference to consider, which there still is with Tokyo. But, you know, they could only tune in to a really choppy, broken kind of live stream. They were, you know, happy to do it to cheer me on, but it's changed so much. I'm so excited that so many people can see the Paralympics here.
What does the prominence of the Paralympics mean for adaptive sports for people with disabilities around the country who may not have their eyes on Olympic level competition?
Yeah, it just opens up so many avenues, not only to exercise and make connections. You know, there's even research that connects participation in adapted sports to better employment outcomes for people with disabilities. So for us, you know, we get all the benefits of sports that non-disabled individuals would. But I think it also, the Paralympics and adapted sports also offer not only entertainment and just excitement for non-disabled spectators, but if you haven't seen the games, I just encourage you to tune in. You know, usually the competition is just super close. The adaptations are, you know, what you might not have considered. There's so much creativity. And so really, it's got something to offer for everybody.
Now, I have heard concerns from some athletes and others about accessibility to the games. For example, Becca Myers, a three-time Paralympic gold medalist, withdrew from the swimming team, the U.S. team this year, because she wouldn't be allowed to travel with her mother because of COVID restrictions. Becca, deaf and blind, relies on her mother to travel to competitions. What do you think that tells us about, missing story of accessibility to the Paralympics?
Yeah. Becca's story really touched me. And, you know, I hope you've been able to hear how passionate I am about the Paralympics and about Team USA. And I really think this is an area that we need to grow and improve. You know, athletes, I lived at the Olympic and Paralympic Training Center for months before I competed, and I had access to top-notch everything. I mean, dietitians, sports psychologists. And so really, for the U.S. delegation to be falling behind in their approach to supporting athletes is disappointing, and is not only holding us back, you know, in this case, in portrayals in the media, but also, I have no doubt, on the medal stand. You know, some of the story around Becca has been questioning whether her mother should be allowed to go and kind of that relationship. But what's important to note is that when you have a disability and you're on the world stage competing, you know, at your peak athletic moment, you want the best supports possible, whether that be the best trainer, the best massage therapist. And so it really can't just be anyone who will step in and help you if you absolutely need it. It should be a person of your choosing that can meet your unique disability related needs. And, you know, I know COVID added stressors to the game, but I can't help but notice, you know, a number of individuals from those giving out medals to, you know, those supporting athletes in other ways that somehow were able to attend and be a part of the delegation.
Do you see the problem being a lack of resources being put into the Paralympics, financial resources in particular, or is there a mindset where people just aren't connecting the dots here, or is it a little bit of both?
I really think the mindset is more at play here. We have this idea that, you know, athleticism negates disability, or that these two things can't exist together. And that's just not the case. Unfortunately, I think there is some ableism within the, you know, Paralympic approach in this case. And we have to understand that just because someone needs some supports doesn't make them, you know, any less of an athlete or an employee or a parent or, you know, whatever their role may be. And so I really wish that it would be approached in the same way that we approach supporting athletes with the best of the best, so that, you know, really they can reach their top performance.
I've had a lot of conversations with people from various disabilities communities making the case that, hey, if you are trying to come up with policies that accommodate us, that's great. Why not bring us to the table and we can help you figure out what's going to help us? Is that part of the story here, where Paralympic athletes need to be at the table to help figure out some of these things?
Totally. Yeah. There's an important mantra within our disability community that's nothing about us without us. And I think this is the case here, that I hope that some of the planners and leaders at the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee will look back on this and reflect that no doubt we've had a successful game, but I'm sure other stories will emerge of athletes that struggled with their disability due to, you know, lacking supports. And it's also unfair to some of the people who pick up this slack. So I've seen it cited in stories that coaches are expected to provide disability related supports. You know, that's really not their role or background. And while it's great that teammates often help each other as teammates, it shouldn't come down to that, because, you know, what can and what has happened per the reports of athletes is that there have been moments where, you know, someone hasn't remembered, or they haven't been able to find some help in this informal way. And, you know, it's resulted in people being lost and people being, you know, anxious and nervous, and just things that shouldn't happen when you're getting ready to compete for your country.
We're talking to Kara Ayers, assistant professor at the University of Cincinnati and a former Paralympian swimmer. We're looking at the Paralympic Games going on right now, how they've changed over the years, where there's room for improvement in the future. And Kara, I know you work as part of your job with parents who have disabilities, families dealing with disabilities issues. Staying with the sports theme, though, where do you see opportunities for growth and improvement in accessibility to adaptive sports?
Yeah, I think, getting the word out about adapted sports is something that the Paralympics can trigger for a lot of people. I've seen more dialogue around people saying, wow, have you seen this sport called goalball, which is kind of like soccer for blind athletes? And so, part of it is awareness and visibility of adapted sports. Also, we just need our community to become more inclusive and accessible overall. So I love the uptick in, accessible and inclusive playgrounds so that our family, both myself and my husband use wheelchairs and we have three kids. And so we want to be able to go to sports fields and parks. And, we go to my daughter's softball games and really enjoy that sports culture as disabled adults. And so part of it comes down to community accessibility and inclusion as well.
Who needs to take the lead at the local level to make sure that that soccer sideline is accessible, just the baseline kind of stuff like that?
Yeah. I've seen great work done by, some city councils, some mayors have picked it up as initiatives, as well as, Parks Board. It's also been a great opportunity for different philanthropic organizations who, want to find really impactful ways to spend grant money. It's to renovate or update playgrounds or parks really makes a huge difference in these communities. And just remembering that people with disabilities, we are a part of every spectrum. So a lot of times we think about these playgrounds for the kids in wheelchairs, which of course they benefit. But like my family, it also benefits the parents with disabilities who come to play with their kids and grandparents who come to play with their kids and their grandkids. So it really is impactful across the community, and anyone can get involved in this at any level.
Focused a lot on the community level and the organizational level. Can you speak to people out there or parents out there who might be dealing with disabilities themselves, and athletics hasn't been on their radar? They think, well, the athletic world isn't built for me. What would you say to them?
Yeah, I think that you might be surprised, if you think about what your interests are, especially, we saw on the Olympic stage how it's really widened. I enjoyed watching skateboarding and other sports. So I think they may be surprised if they look at what their interests are, that it may fit into, if it's not adapted sports, adapted recreation for sure. And of course, it varies, region by region. Some people who want really specific adapted sports with other athletes with disabilities do end up driving a bit to get those programs. But many people also integrate into their, typical or non-disabled sports programs, whether at their schools or in their communities. And that absolutely can be a way to get involved as well.
In just our last minute, of course, we're still in the midst of the 2020 games, technically the 2020 games now. What are you hoping has changed by 2024 in Paris for the Paralympics?
Oh, great question. Thinking about kind of our hope for the future. My hope would be that we figure out how to match our support of athletes related to their disabilities in the same way that we do these multiple other components. So, we've recognized the increased importance, I think, of mental health and of diet and of, different innovative training plans. And so I hope that disability supports are considered with that same kind of microscope of innovation so that we can reach excellence. In a lot of ways, Team USA is trying to catch up with other countries in the Paralympics, and this is a way that we can do that.
We'll leave it there. Kara, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Kara Ayers is the Associate Director and an Assistant Professor at the University of Cincinnati's University Center for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities. Kara is a Paralympian swimmer who competed in the 2004 Games in Athens. We also heard from our own Megan Hart, WPR sports reporter, about the Wisconsin representation in Team USA in the Tokyo Games right now. You can read more of her reporting over at WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, Sarah Chase left a career as a journalist to work with people in Afghanistan. She shares her thoughts on the long U.S. intervention there and what happens next. One of the biggest slumps in baseball just came to an end. Can we take some lessons for individuals? Find out how we can try to break out of our own personal doldrums in our daily lives. And a new guide to memorable quotations is out. We'll find out what phrases made the list and what it takes for words to stand the test of time. Plus, a look at the stress and strain facing nurses around the country as COVID-19 still keeps going and concerns about nursing shortages. That and more. It's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Big news for fans of a unique cocktail, the Bloody Mary. There's a new winner for the best Bloody Mary in Wisconsin. As reported yesterday by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, at a contest a handful of days back, the Algoma bar called Smashed on the Rocks Saloon won the People's Choice Award for Best Bloody Mary at a contest held at Fiserv Forum. Now, I'm not a Bloody Mary guy. I don't like tomato juice, which kills the experience. But Central Time producer Tim Peterson is a fan. Hey, Tim.
Hey, Rob.
How do you convey the joy of the Bloody Mary to people, even to those of us who it's kind of a non-starter?
You know, when you asked me why I like Bloody Marys earlier today, I had to be honest with myself. I'm like, why do I like Bloody Marys? And as I was thinking about it and looking in the ingredients, I realized that the ingredients of Worcestershire sauce and celery salt are kind of two comfort food flavors for me. Growing up, I ate a lot of Chex Mix, so Worcestershire sauce, and we had a lot of seafood with Old Bay on it living on the East Coast, so celery salt, and there you go.
And then what do you like? People put, you know, a little bit of vegetable on top or, you know, a whole salad. What do you like topping your Bloody Mary?
I like to go classic. I like celery stock, bacon, but, you know, I am not above having a slider, having a brat. You know, you name it, kind of on top and in the side, just sloshing around.
It all sounds great, except for the drink itself. That's Tim Peterson. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.